Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Jonathan Prack. Today's podcast is a recording of the event Careers and Development, co-hosted by the ANU Aid and Development Learning Community. At the event, aspiring young professionals were given the opportunity to hear from a panel of experts talk about their own careers in the aid program, NGOs, and the private sector. There's plenty of time for questions from the audience, so be sure to stick around to the end of the podcast.
Hey everyone, might get started now if you're ready. Okay. So I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight. It's great to have such a good turnout and see that there are so many people interested in the topic. Tonight's event is a collaboration between the Aid and Development Learning Community and the Development Policy Centre. So I thought I'd just give you a bit of a brief introduction and background as to what inspired the event and hopefully what you'll enjoy this evening. So this year, this semester is my last year of my degree and, well, my last semester. And I was thinking as I was approaching it that I wasn't really sure on where I was actually going to go with it. I knew that, well, I've known for a long time that I was interested in aid and development as an area, but it's a very broad field. Like many of you know, it covers everything from economics to sociology, to anthropology, agriculture. It's quite enormous when you think about it. And it can be quite daunting to consider where to actually start if you're looking at following a career in that sector. So after talking to a few people at the Crawford School, I realized that this was not just me feeling a little bit lost, that there wasn't really a specific guideline or way to go to get into aid and development areas. So tonight's event, we hope, will not necessarily, well, won't give you any specific, this is what you have to do to have a successful career, but hopefully some of the speakers here will be able to give you some guidance and share some of their experiences about how they went through the process of getting to where they are now, and you can ask them some questions to get a better understanding yourself about what you're actually interested in and if this is something which you'd like to pursue. And with that, I'll hand over to our MC for tonight, who's Jonathan Pack from the Development Policy Centre. So please make him welcome.
Thank you. So I'd just like to begin the proceedings today by acknowledging and celebrating the traditional owners of this land, the Ngunnawal people, and pay respect to the elders past and present. So as Sarah said, my name is Jonathan Pryke. I'm a research officer at the Development Policy Centre. We are Australia's only think tank that focuses exclusively on aid and development, and we're based right here at the ANU. Sarah's stolen most of my lines introducing the event today, so we might just skip over that and I'll jump into introducing our four speakers that are part of this excellent panel that we've put together for you tonight. I'll introduce all our speakers one after the other so we can quickly roll through the proceedings, and then each speaker will have between 10 to 15 minutes to share their insights with us, followed by roughly 30 minutes of Q&A from the audience. So our first speaker this evening is Jackie DeLacy. Jackie is General Manager for International Development at, now I don't know how to say this properly,
at JTA,
which is a development contractor based in Brisbane. Prior to this position, Jackie held multiple senior positions at AusAid, including as the head of Australia's bilateral aid program in Indonesia. Jackie will be followed by Alwyn Chilvers. Alwyn is Director of GRM International's Growth, Private Sector and Livelihoods Practice. GRM is also an international development contractor. An agricultural economist by training, Alwyn spent 7 years as AusAid's principal advisor on rural development and the environment. Now, not to be completely dominated by former AusAid staffers, we also have Chris Adams following Alwyn. Chris is the Growth and Effectiveness Manager at ACFID, the Australian Council for International Development, which is Australia's peak body for development NGOs in Australia. Chris has worked in a variety of development NGOs in a variety of positions over the past 20 years. And our final speaker tonight will be Ashley Betteridge. Ashley is another research officer here at the Development Policy Centre. A former journalist, she worked at the Jakarta Globe from 2008 to 2010 and for News Limited in Sydney. She's also worked in communications for Plan International and Timor-Leste. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Jackie to come up and share some of her insights. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. And it's incredible to me that there are so many people in this room. I studied at university a very long time ago. I graduated in 1989 and I was doing economics at the time. And I was pretty much the only person I knew who was interested in development. This was in Queensland, but it's really inspirational for me to see so many people sitting in this room who are contemplating a career in development. And I'm an optimist and I've had a fabulous career, so I'm not going to put you off it, and let's hope that the rest of the panellists do the same. I'll try and keep my presentation pretty short because I think it would be better to have more sort of question and answer time. I'll talk briefly about what my professional journey, mostly as Jonathan was explaining, in AusAid and its predecessor ADAB and its successor DFAT. But then I'll spend about 5 minutes talking about some of the things I've learned along the way that I think will contribute to a happy, maybe not successful, but definitely a happy career in development. So here's the quick summary of my career. So I was born in the highlands of Papua New Guinea in a little town called Goroka, which is absolutely gorgeous, and then spent the next 9 years living just outside another town in the highlands of Papua New Guinea called Mount Hagen. It's a very beautiful part of the world, but it's also a very troubled part of the world. There's lots of problems in the highlands of PNG. It's almost as troubled as it is beautiful. And I remember when I was young trying to reconcile why things were so different for the mothers of my PNG girlfriends compared to the life of my own mother. So in Papua New Guinea, the women hang around together a lot, so I got to know these women quite well. I mean, they were smart, they were funny, they were kind, they were just like my mum, really. But they had very little power, and quite a few of them used to get regularly beaten up by their husbands. And I found that a very confronting situation. I mean, in some ways, they formed great relationships with each other and supported each other through these events. But I remember just being so puzzled that the men could get away with doing this so regularly to women. And I think that that was really what sparked my interest in development. And I cannot remember wanting to do anything else. So all through, you know, when we moved back to Australia and I went to high school, all I wanted to do was development. I went to university, as I said, in Queensland, the University of Queensland. I actually studied law and economics, but after 3 years of law, I realised that it wasn't actually going to contribute much practically to a development career. So I then focused on an honours degree in economics, which I think was more relevant for me and where I wanted to go. After I graduated with honours economics at the University of Queensland, I went straight in to be a graduate economist in ADAB, as it was then, so the predecessor to AusAid. So I went straight from university into AusAid. I then spent 22 years working for this institution in a wide range of roles. It's incredible, isn't it? 22 years. And I never, ever intended to stay that long. I mean, who does? But, I never set out saying, I want a career, I want to rise up through the ranks of this organisation. It was simply that I just got one interesting assignment after another, and that just simply added up to a lot of years. I spent quite a lot of time working on the Pacific, which is obviously always a big focus of AusAid and ADAB as it was then. But I also had two postings to Indonesia, and I had a stint in New York. So yes, I got paid to go and live in New York City to work at Australia's mission to the UN. And that certainly gave me a connection to New York. It is honestly the best city in the world, I can say that. But it also taught me that I wasn't cut out for multilateral negotiations. And so my first piece of advice is avoid them at all costs. Unless they give you a chance to live in New York, maybe that's worth it. I've also worked up at Parliament House as an advisor to a minister, which I learnt a lot from, and in particular, the complexity of selling the aid program politically within Parliament House and to other parliamentarians. But I also spent a couple of years managing AusAid's budgets, which was surprisingly enlightening. And I probably learnt more through budget, more about AusAid and the program as a whole through that budget experience than any other single job I had in AusAid. Policies, press releases, white papers, results frameworks, they come and they go. I've worked on many of them myself. But the really hard policy decisions are made when the money gets divvied up at budget time. So if you're interested in the aid program, I really stress to you all, you should learn how to read budget bills and follow the money more than you follow the words, because that's when policy is really enacted. So my last job in AusAid, as Jonathan mentioned, was managing our aid program in Indonesia. Now, this was a real privilege. We had a very, and still do, have a very successful aid program in Indonesia at about $500 million a year. And it is a genuine partnership with the Indonesian government, and it's focusing on trying to help Indonesia solve some very critical poverty problems that affect nearly 100 million people. So, you know, it's a significant scale. Now, when I was there, I went in the beginning of 2010 and I left midway through 2013, and all the stars were aligned. So we had a very big and growing budget, so we had a lot of money that we could spend and a lot of new money that we could allocate. So there was space to do new things. I had fabulous staff. We had a lot of really talented Indonesian staff, predominantly Indonesian staff, but we had some amazing international advisors, and I had great Australian staff as well. We were trusted by the Indonesian government and all the various agencies that we work with. And when you have trust, it means you can actually work closely with them on their priorities. But we were also working with, and since I'd spent a lot of my life working on the Pacific, we were also working with a government that was stable, where ministers were in the same job for year after year, senior bureaucrats were in the same job year after year, so there was a lot of stability. And it was also a government that was largely committed to poverty reduction in a genuine way. There were lots of other problems, but they did really care about poverty. It's very rare to get all of those a combination of events in one place. It's never happened to me before. In fact, it's the only time it had ever happened to me in my career that I'd managed to get all of that in one place. And of course, it meant that I loved it. And it meant that we could help design and implement a really innovative and effective program. But it was demanding on me both personally and professionally. It was a lot of work. So after 3.5 years in that job, I had to leave. I had James Gilling knocking on my door saying, get out, I've got to take over. And, you know, I had to really think about what to do next. And I came to the conclusion that there was no other job in AusAid, as it was then, soon to become DFAT, that I would find as fulfilling as the job I had just done in Indonesia. The other challenge I had was that I really wanted to regain some work-life balance. I'm a working mother, and I found that the more senior I became, at least in government, the more difficult it was for me to have the time that I wanted with my own children. And I came to the hard realisation that going back and being a division head in Canberra and being an engaged mother were incompatible. So I basically resigned and took some time off, and I've recently joined an innovative and very ethical private sector company called ATJTA. I have to practice how to say that. And I'm really loving that. But it is a part-time job, which gives me more time to be the mother that I also want to be. So another piece of advice is that you should work really hard to find work that you love. You spend a lot of your life at work, so do something you love. But remember, it is only part of your life. So make sure that work fits your life, not your life has to fit your work. So just keep that in mind as well. So what have I learned along the way? Well, first of all, I never planned my career. In hindsight, I could never have anticipated the sort of opportunities and choices that I was given over the course of my career. I simply just took one interesting job after another. And reflecting for tonight, it occurred to me that a lot of the time I was drawn to interesting work because of the people I would be working with rather than the subject matter per se or even the geography. And I've never, ever regretted that. So, for example, early on in my career, and maybe this is partly because of my my history, I was drawn to some really exciting people that were working on Papua New Guinea. So I spent a lot of my early years working on development issues in PNG. But this was at a time, this is a long time ago, remember, 25 years ago. This is at a time when a lot of people were really interested in working on Africa and working on Latin America. The Pacific and PNG in particular were not at all sexy topics to work on, but I can't imagine that I could have learnt more working anywhere else in the world. And still to this day, when I read a development book or read an article coming out of, you know, Harvard Kennedy School or from ANU, I still think about PNG when I read it, and I try and contemplate what it means for the reality of working in PNG. It's a great touchstone for me, even today when I haven't worked on PNG for maybe 10 years now. I had some amazing mentors, and this is another great benefit about development, is you will meet some extraordinary people. They're not always going to be the easiest people to work with, but there's some extraordinary people working on development. So I recommend you continually search them out and try and be helpful to them and attach yourself to them and do things for them so that you can hang around and work with them and learn from them. It certainly worked for me. My career has been overwhelmingly positive. I've been challenged and engaged and interested throughout all of the years. I've never wanted to do anything else. I'm still learning something all the time. You never give up learning when you choose to do development. And I've been amazed on many occasions that people pay me to do the work that I do. I'm very happy to be paid, but oftentimes I would have been happy to do it. Maybe slightly less happy, but I would have done it without pay at all. Don't tell my boss. No one knows Jane here, right? I do have a few regrets. I wish I had been a volunteer. I really think that was a gap in my experience, going out and working directly in a community. So when you get postings with the government, you're working more at the national level with national institutions. You visit the field a lot, but you're not living there. And I really think that was a gap, and I regret that I wasn't a volunteer before starting with ADAP. I wish I had read more widely at uni. You saw all of you, keep reading. I wish I was better at languages. You know, if you can communicate with people directly, it's a lot better. So focus on languages. And I also wish I understood our approach to Indigenous disadvantage better so that I could have learned from that. So I do have some regrets, but they're minor compared with the positives that I've experienced. I've been asked many times, how do you get a start in development? How do you get your first break? How do you get your first job? But I seriously think that through choosing relevant study, volunteering, learning language, and then being willing to work where the jobs are, anyone can get a start in development. And here's a hint, most of the jobs are in Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Indonesia. So they're the languages you need to focus on, and they're the countries you should gain experience about. Once you're on your way, once you're in development and contemplating a long-term career, then I think there are a number of characteristics that you should sort of actively foster if you want to be happy and want to be successful. So the first is you should be curious. You've got to ask a lot of questions in development. You've got to keep getting different perspectives. You've got to listen to what people are saying, and you've got to observe what is happening. And you've got to keep trying to puzzle out solutions. Last year I was in Timor-Leste. We were looking at a program, a community development program, that's trying to get communities more engaged with health services. So, you know, how do you get, you know, in a post-conflict society where people have been very not connected to government at all, how do you get them more interested and engaged and hold the health services more accountable? And one of the places we went to, there was all this data on the wall of the village, and it looked fabulous. You know, this was a community that was tracking health services. But when we asked them about it, they basically said it was data for someone else. None of them understood what was on the wall. So if you don't ask the questions, you're not going to understand the context. Second, you've got to be critical and you've got to be open to criticism. Nearly everyone working in development is doing it because they love it, but it leads to biases. You're working on programs that you love, so you look for evidence that what you're working on is succeeding. And often you're doing that without even knowing it. So be critical of yourself, be critical of your colleagues, and be open to criticism. Third, be nice. Development is about people. People whose choices you're trying to enhance, people who control the systems and budgets and policies that you're trying to change, people who are funding your programs. You've got to get along with people and you've got to be able to negotiate with them. Fourth, be determined. Development is hard, it is iterative, and you're going to make many, many mistakes. Certainly I've made many, many mistakes, and you've got to be able to learn from them, and you've got to keep plugging away at problems. And finally, you've got to be tough. You've got to cultivate a strong stomach, an even stronger bladder. You've got to be able to have a fearless attitude to flying and dangerous driving. And I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but seriously, no one should be in this business unless they're prepared, they're willing and they're able to travel and visit all of the dirty, disparate, difficult places where poor people live. And to do that is going to require all of the things that I just said. It's in communities where poor people live that you need to read your development books. That's where you've got to ask your questions. That's where you've got to challenge your beliefs. So my final piece of advice is if you're going to do development, spend a lot of time in the field, either long-term or short-term, but that's where you're going to get the inspiration for a career. Thank you.
Evening, everyone, and thanks a lot. Thank you very much for inviting me here. It's a real privilege to be here. I've taken a slightly different tack from Jackie. I mean, courtesy of actually a couple of the younger people I work with these days, I sort of was scratching my head for quite a long time as to what would be a useful sort of approach to take. And I don't think it's going to be terribly useful, but I've come up with 7 or 8 points that I'm just going to share. And before I go to those points, I genuinely want to make the or request your indulgence or your forgiveness, because I realise as I made these points and discussed it with my colleagues, they could sound like rather pompous, sort of like I'm this sagely, worldly wise kind of guy, which I'm definitely not. But they are well intentioned, my comments. And you know, I've had a fantastic career, a really rewarding career in development. The other, and I want to sort of, I suppose, encourage others to get into it and to help change the world and make it a better place. And that's the last thing I'll say in terms of context. I don't criticise whoever wrote the blurb for this gathering. I think it's a fantastic idea, whoever organised it. But I really, as Jackie said in her closing, I'm interested in appealing to the people who want to achieve sustainable change, make the world a better place, not people who want to travel to interesting countries and meet interesting people. So with that sort of perhaps slightly over-serious start, I guess my first comment is that the development industry has really changed. You guys would probably know that better than me. I'm a similar age to Jackie, I think I'm rather older, but it really has got ever more professional. I, like Jackie, I was brought up in a difficult country called Nigeria, and I had a bit of a moment where I suddenly, as a kid, I was walking around and I saw these rusting tractors around, and I said, you know, I found out from my parents, what's going on here, you know, surely, you know, why are these rusting tractors around? They said, oh, it's a World Bank program called Operation Feed the Nation. And from that moment, I was convicted, a bit like Jackie, when seeing her disempowered PNG mothers. You know, I thought, well, I'm sure I can do a better job than that. And so I grew up with a very early commitment to sort of, I wanted to do something better. And because we lived in rural Nigeria, we had all sorts of VSOs, and the Australian equivalent is Australian Volunteers. They were coming through, they were teaching English, they were doing all sorts of things, and they would come and my mother would feed them up and then move them on, send them back to their bush schools where they were teaching or whatever. So when I graduated from university with a degree in geography, I sort of cruised along to the VSO tent at the careers base and said, you know, I'm up for this, I know what living overseas is like. And they said, sorry, no, we're not interested. Geography degree, you know, not interested. If you've got computer engineering, maybe we'll talk to you. But that really hit me in the guts. It was a real surprise because already at age 21 or 22, graduating from university, you know, I'd seen people who just had, who didn't even have degrees teaching in Nigeria. 5 years later, I had a degree. The world had moved on, and I wasn't any use to development I wasn't any use to development unless I had a really specific skill. So the development industry has changed, and more importantly, I think it's going to change rapidly, much further. Jackie talked about the aid program. I think what you guys want to work in is the development industry, and the development industry is much more than aid programs. It's a lot to do with business these days, and what businesses do and the impact that businesses have on countries around the world is going to transform how poor countries become rich countries, how poor people become rich people and stay out of poverty. The aid game will have a role to play, but I genuinely believe, and I think it's a really important thing for you guys to think about, don't think that you have to go and work on an aid program or in an NGO. Think about working in business and finding skills in business and taking your attitude in business into countries where there is poverty, and see how businesses can drive change. I mean, that is already happening in a very big way, and I really encourage you to sort of broaden your minds as you think about that. Related, really, there's a lot of jobs in development. I'm certainly not going to necessarily advocate my pathway, but you know, you can be a technical person. You can develop technical skills. You can develop bureaucratic skills. The development needs lots of administrators and bureaucrats. You can develop political skills, advising ministers, advising mayors, advising all sorts of people in government is a really important role. Logistics. There's no end of roles in development. Project management. Obviously, I mean, the businesses run projects. Okay, it's not just development organisations that run projects, but project management skills and being able to run a project really sharply is a really important skill that's very relevant in development. And you can get that in business. You can get that in all sorts of places. Another thought, and these are, sorry, there's really no coherence in my thoughts. They're just a stream of thoughts that sort of I gleaned from talking to colleagues. What do I look for, actually, when I'm looking to hire young professionals? First off, actually, same thing as Jackie said, I look for inquiring minds, people who don't just believe what they read or believe what they even see. They challenge, they think there must be a deeper explanation. There must be a cause behind this symptom. People who want to sort of understand more, who want to listen, want to learn. For me, it's really important to have to work with people who are committed to achieving change that's going to last. But above all, it's having people with inquiring minds, people who challenge the status quo, people who think beyond what they can just see from a quick glance. And I'm sorry to say, there's lots of people in development who take a quick look. Actually, the culture in our industry is to fly into PNG or Indonesia, stay there a week and come out and write a nice review or a bad review about a program you've looked at for 5 days or for 10 days if you're lucky. So I look for people who want to dig deeper, want to ask the hard questions and really want to understand what's going on. Really banal comment, lucky breaks will always be important in kickstarting your career. But as all good rugby, soccer, basketball coaches say, you do make your own luck. So in that, I really encourage you to sort of put yourself about, associate with people you admire. Volunteering is a fantastic way, interning is a fantastic way to get the opportunity. You know, being, if you're that committed, be willing to kind of almost do anything, not quite anything. But seriously, I mean, that's how I felt when I got this kick in the guts from VSO. I was prepared to take a loan from the bank to fly out to some country and just work for nothing. I don't know, it's easier said than done. But if you put yourself about, luck will come your way. And as all good coaches say, you know, if you create your own luck. One certainly rather sad thing to say, I think, as you go about creating your own luck, it's kind of helpful to know the development jargon. And probably some of you are doing development courses, so you might be already slightly immersed in it. And we, you know, Jackie, I'm sure all of us, we use that development lingo, and it's kind of crap. But we use it a lot, and actually it does help communicate with those people who are working in development and sort of thinking about development roles. So learn it. Make sure you can communicate in it. Don't necessarily count on using it. If you can change the world that way, that's a good thing. The other thing I found really, really useful as a sort of a generic point is, maybe it's just the way my brain works, but I've always had a framework of analysis that I've sort of viewed the world in. For many years, for me, it was the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework. More recently, I've sort of shifted my mind from that an analytical framework to what's called the Market Development Framework, or an M4P framework. I think, as Jackie says, you know, really important point, those aren't your Bibles. They don't tell you how to understand a situation, but they do. They allow you to sort of try and look at the world in front of you and ask start to know what the questions are to ask and start to dig and start to understand. So I think that's a really important thing. If you want to get into development, find a framework that works with your brain, with your head, understand it, you know, and practice using it. And I think a lot of things fall into place. You know, a framework is just an analytical framework, but try and find one that works for you. Two final comments, actually. Know why you're in development. Really, I'm maybe just going back to that original commitment point. As Jackie says, you know, if you really want to do something, make the world a better place, you need to be prepared to do some difficult things. Sometimes be away from your family for a long time, be away from friends, go to difficult places, have some scary experiences. Obviously, take very good care of yourselves, but you need to be up for that sort of thing. And then finally, my two colleagues said to me, you know, what's really important is actually being willing to compromise. When you're young, you're idealistic, and perhaps that can get in the way. And I think they are right. I'm not a great compromiser, personally, as Jackie knows. and it's probably cost me, you know, a few things in my career, and I probably have a few regrets for not being a bit more compromising. But maybe a better word than compromise is not to be too idealistic, but to be realistic. My views on development, I don't think it's just because I've become, you know, gone from a young idealistic sort of student guy to a sort of a crusty old man with wife and kids and all that. I do think I've learned a lot on the way, and I think that is so important. It's easy to say, it rolls off the tongue. But my views on how development happens have changed dramatically over my 25-odd years in development. The things that are important to me, I was so, those days in Nigeria, I was so damn committed to making sure those poor farmers in the back of Nigeria got all the help they need and the extension service reached them and all that. And the way I thought about things was kind of screwed up, I realise now. And actually, the way to get sort of change that's going to last and going to really achieve scale and reach lots of people, the ways I try to go about things now are very, very different. So it's an easy thing to say. Make sure you learn as you go. But as Jackie says, keep your mind open. Be prepared to be criticised. Be prepared to... Actually, I mean, one of the biggest changes in my life, you know, I nearly came to a fist fight with a guy who had a completely different view of development from me, and we were so passionate about it. You know, it was embarrassing. We almost hit each other, but fortunately we didn't. And, you know, a couple of years later, I sort of acknowledged that, you know, his ideas were more close to reality than mine. So keep on learning. Thanks very much.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here, and fascinating to hear the two speakers and hear echoes of what I'm about to say tonight. I've been working in the sector for about 20 years. I didn't start in the sector. I trained as a petroleum geologist many, many years ago at Melbourne University. I never worked as one. The closest I got was digging ditches in a mine site in Western Australia. And then, courtesy of a motorbike accident in my honours year, I ended up just knocking around Southeast Asia and South Asia for a couple of years. And in those days, the hippie trail through Southeast Asia, South Asia was sort of replete with books like The Snow Leopard and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and Siddhartha. They're probably still out there. But so you know, for me, that was all about a journey of self-discovery and seeing the world in different ways, which then had an influence, obviously, in my career choices when I came back. I knew I didn't want to work as a geologist. And just towards the end of the time in Southeast Asia, I spent 6 weeks on a Tibetan retreat centre in Dharamsala. Just reflecting on what I'd done for a year and what I might do once I was back in Australia. And the wonderful thing about the Mahayana Buddhist tradition is that it focuses not only on the personal salvation, but also on social transformation. And I think those two things were a key part of then deciding what I did when I came back to Australia. And that was to live in a Catholic worker community, an offshoot of a Catholic worker community, which is actually where I met Stephen, the head of the policy unit here. The Catholic worker communities were sort of established in the interwar years in the United States by a communist-turned-Catholic who sort of continued her sort of radical politics, combined her radical politics then with the traditional Catholic works of mercy, and they set up houses of hospitality all around the states. And us in our naivety decided we'd set up something similar in Melbourne, and a bunch of 10, 15, 20 of us at times were involved in sort of living in solidarity with people living on the streets of Melbourne. And we were involved in all the movements of the day, the Latin American solidarity, the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-nuclear movement, you name it, we were out there on the streets, either living on the streets or stomping up and down the streets calling for change. Those communities collapsed, as communities do. And then, because I'd worked with homeless people, I ended up working in Society of St. Vincent de Paul for 6 years in a emergency relief centre, Ozenham House in Melbourne. And Ozenham, who it's named after, was probably a bit of a radical in his day. He was a social democrat. This is back in mid-18th century France. So he's a republican, a social reformist, as well as involved in sort of the works of mercy. But again, you know, movements get co-opted, transformed into organisations. Organisations become conservative, and certainly the Society of St. Vincent de Paul at that time had become quite conservative, and Ozenham House, the relief centre I worked in, was a very, very conservative institution. And again, that's sort of a lesson I've carried forward with me about, you know, institutions are important, but they wax and wane. They're the blunt instruments that we need to work with, and they need to be reformed so that they actually work in the interests of poor people and not against them. And then from there, I decided, and I'd always been interested in international development from the time that I'd been overseas, and I thought, well, I can either get in by taking the specialist route or the generalist route. I thought about doing hydrogeology. Started one subject and the maths just completely defeated me, so I went and did a Master's in Development Studies. and that was in the early days of Development Studies courses, so it was just a grab bag of, you know, Anthropology 101, Politics 103, da-da-da-da. I didn't really have a coherent body of theory behind it. But it did give me an opportunity just to step back and reflect on development issues and to try and locate some of that experience when I'd just been bumming around Southeast Asia in a larger historic and globalised frame. And then I was fortunate at the end of that to be able to get a job in what was then Community Aid Abroad, now Oxfam, one of the larger INGOs in Australia. I got knocked back by World Vision First, which was probably a good thing, because they just asked me about whether I prayed every morning. Fortunately, they've changed, and there are very good people now in... There are very good people in World Vision and doing very good things. I have to say that I'm with ACFID. So, yeah. But I guess what was interesting in starting at Community Aid Abroad was having come out of a development studies course, which was all about big picture, macroeconomic, political transitions, to come into Community Aid Abroad at that time, which was all about you know, the old thing about, you know, give a man a fish and you feed them for a day, and teach them how to fish and you feed them for life. And those two things just didn't really gel. So for the next sort of 4 or 5 years was really a bit of a journey of discovery about how you bring together those community-based approaches to change with the need for a much larger political economic change. And I was really fortunate in the first few years to work in eastern Indonesia and with southern Thailand, and to work with really quite remarkable people who really influenced my thinking about development, and particularly about the role of building civil society, strengthening social movements, and the role that they then play in holding governments to account in the interests of poor people. And then from there, I took a year off. I became a volunteer. I was fortunate enough to sit on a plane next to the then head of Australian Volunteers International and said, "Oh, I'm interested in working with this organisation in Bangkok. Can you turn that into a volunteer placement for me?" And he said yes, and off I was. I don't think you can do that now, I'm sure. That mob was called Focus on the Global South. They're still around. Again, set up by a couple of quite remarkable people. They're a bunch of unreconstructed Marxists, basically, from the 60s and 70s, still kicking around, and still very strong on building movements for change. And their mantra is de-globalisation. Closing down the WTO, radically downsizing the World Bank, etc. I think the one of the founder's colleagues in France, who has just been deposed as economic minister, he'd written a book on deglobalisation. but for them, from them again, yeah, even if I didn't necessarily agree with all of the politics and the analysis, it was that emphasis on remaining grounded in social movements and the emphasis on long-term transformation in the interests of poor people. So after a few years there, I came back to what was then Oxfam Australia, and I worked in their program development team, which was the team that develops frameworks, guidelines, tools, etc., to support those who are directly involved in program implementation. So again, that was a great opportunity just to sort of step back from practice and to reflect on it and try and translate that into tools which then enabled others to do good practice. And then I went to, then I switched from Oxfam Australia to Oxfam Hong Kong, and lived in Hong Kong for the last 6 years, managing their work in the Mekong, mostly working on rural livelihoods, particularly in upland areas. And because it was within Oxfam Hong Kong and their largest program was in China, we were looking particularly at the impact of Chinese trade and investment flows on smallholder farmers in upland areas, in border areas, which was a fascinating exercise, and we were looking at ways of trying to bring about policy change in both in sending countries and in receiving countries. I wouldn't say successfully, but a fascinating project to work on for a time. And then I spent a year consulting after I finished up with Oxfam Hong Kong. Over the years, I've sort of developed a bit of a passion for facilitation and participatory and collaborative approaches to change, so I sort of specialised my consulting work in that area. And working with NGOs on designing and facilitating workshops, primarily focused on strategic planning reviews, etc. And then I decided it was time to come back to Oz, and I was just really fortunate to be offered the job at the Australian Council for International Development, which I'm in now, which is the sort of the member-facing part of the Australian Council. So we did a lot of work focused on improving the practice of our member agencies, so looking at setting and maintaining standards and capacity building, and trying to draw out and share and help agencies apply the lessons from practice, both their own practice and others' practice. So in terms of STEM thinking, as the other speakers have done, well, what does that mean then for careers? Well, yeah, mine's gone all over the place, not particularly planned. And certainly the sector has changed dramatically since when I started. It was relatively easy to get a foot in the door 20 years ago. Interestingly, you know, community aid abroad at that time, there was almost no one with a Master's in Development Studies. There was very few Master's in Development Studies in Australia at that time. which also made it quite an interesting place to work. People drawing from all sorts of, drawing all sorts of life experience. And certainly the sector has professionalised and bureaucratised and become more specialised, I think, over that period, for good or for ill. There's a risk, obviously, in that process that development becomes seen as projects with prescribed results, and we distance ourselves from and even become quite corrosive of the social movements which have really driven a lot of change in the world over the years. Feminism gets reduced to gender analytical frames, empowerment gets reduced to PRA, so movements become technical tools co-opted by institutions. But that said, there are still good agencies out there doing really good things. It's just that there's still a relatively small pool of agencies and relatively few entry-level positions, I think, still in those agencies, and a much larger pool of candidates. So it can be pretty tough, intensely competitive to break in. And Masters in Development Studies, which didn't exist 20 years ago, is now almost a prerequisite for a job in development studies. So you need more than that now to distinguish yourself from the pack. What I look for in interviews, which is something that others have commented on, I think, is particularly when you're working, people are applying for jobs in NGOs, which are values-based organisations, is why? Have you thought through why you want to work in development studies? And in particular, is it a job or is it more than a job? What are your informing beliefs, attitudes? What analytical frames do you bring to bear on how you understand the problems that we face, the opportunities that we can exploit? And do you have a reflective disposition? Quite a few people have talked about that already, I think. Are you able to listen, to learn, and then to enable others rather than simply to impose? Because unfortunately, the power relationship in aid and development work is all with the donors. And it's very easy to fall into that way of being with people without even realising that you're doing it. So being able to engage respectfully with others is, I think, a really critical criteria for all of us. And finally, just being able to work across boundaries is really important. Just given the nature of the problems that we face, we talk about wicked problems these days, they can't be solved by one entity alone. So you not only have to have the interpersonal skills, but you've also got to have the skills to be able to work across cultural boundaries, ideological boundaries, organisational boundaries, and build effective coalitions for change. So finally, just to wrap up, I'm sure I'm over time. I think get out there, try different things. It doesn't have to be this sort of unilinear path, Masters in Development Studies, become a program manager. Other speakers have already spoken about the need to bring in skills, to bring in experiences, to bring in perspectives from different walks of life, different sectors into the development field. And we spend a lot of time talking to ourselves, and that's not healthy. It's really good to bring in outside expertise. Build relationships as you go. There are remarkable people out there. Find them, stick to them, learn from them. I've been really fortunate to be able to work over a 20-year career with all of my bosses have been quite extraordinary people, and quite a number of, particularly the field staff who have worked with me, again, really extraordinary, and that's probably where I've learnt the most in all that time. Be willing to act, make mistakes, pick yourself up, learn, try something different. That's a metaphor for development as well as for your own practice. And enjoy it. I mean, it's an extraordinary world out there. Bewildering at times, but it's a really exciting career. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I have a PowerPoint. Don't hate me. But if you want to work in development, you often have to deal with them. It's very short. Thanks. So when I was first asked to speak on a panel about careers in development, I was like, really? Especially when I realized who I'd be speaking up here with today. But then I thought about it and I realized, hang on a second, I actually have a career in development, one that I really enjoy. And I guess I'd spent so long panicking about how to make my career in development happen that I didn't actually notice that it had. So how did I end up here? After working as a journalist for a while, including a couple of years in Indonesia, which I was very fortunate to be thrown an opportunity to go over there and work, I sort of, you know, decided that journalism wasn't doing it for me anymore and that I was really interested in development policy. And some of the reasons why I was interested in aid and development were the same reasons that I was interested in journalism, issues of social justice and so on. So then I tried a lot of different ways to get into the development field. I felt the cold sting of rejection from grad programs at WasAid and DFAT, unlike my colleague Jonathan here, who's turned out half of Canberra to stay with us at Deaf Policy. I tried the quite ridiculous global lottery that is the UN Young Professionals exam. I fumbled my way through interviews for NGOs for positions that I was completely unqualified for at the time. And I did a master's in public policy here at ANU, focusing on development policy in 2011. And I picked up some work at this new cool think tank called the Development Policy Centre. Then, for some reason, I decided to leave that job and go to Timor-Leste on an Australian Volunteers for International Development assignment. So I think it had always been my plan to do one, and I stubbornly kept going forward with the plan, even though I clearly had a good job here, one that I've come back to since. But as my fellow panellists mentioned, volunteering is quite a common way to get into a development career. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And I hope some of my points, I'm mostly talking about the Australian Volunteers Program, but I hope that some of my points are useful for those thinking about other types of volunteering as well. So in some ways, I'm probably a really unlikely candidate to talk about volunteering. For starters, the thing I'm probably most known for in development land is my blog post last year criticising the Australian Volunteers for International Development Program. And this post, it went kind of viral for the Dev Policy blog, which is not quite funny cat video viral, but it's viral enough to get you into really deep conversations at Canberra dinner parties. So that was interesting. I'm actually a failed volunteer. My assignment didn't really work out that well. I only stayed for 6 months instead of 18. And I didn't really use it as some sort of career springboard because I came back to the job I was doing before I left, but with a greater appreciation for it. Volunteering was certainly a learning experience though, and I have no regrets. I did really enjoy my time in Timor, even though I didn't really feel that I achieved or contributed much. Yet here I am to give you advice. So, as we've already heard, volunteering, it's by no means the only way to get into development, but it does seem to be a pretty good one. Here you can see a small sample of stylized career trajectories of some of my friends who now work in development. I've cut out the parts where they stumbled around Europe finding themselves for 6 months and stuff like that. But as you can see, they've leveraged a professional volunteer experience, either with the Australian Volunteers Program or UNV, the UN equivalent, into some impressive early career progress. And we know from the Office of Development Effectiveness Evaluation of AVID, the volunteer program, that around 30% of returned volunteers end up working in development. So it's a pretty good path to try. I could stand here and talk you through the AVID program and how it works, but you can easily find it all on Google. One thing I will quickly clarify, though, is that the Youth Ambassadors program still, it's disappeared, but only in name. The assignments are still there. If you look on the website, there's early career opportunities. So don't be discouraged. There's still opportunities for people under the age of 30 to volunteer through this program. So now that I've dealt with that, I'm going to give you what the volunteer program website or glossy brochures won't give you, and that's the dirt. So while while it can be immensely rewarding and transformative to volunteer, it can also be tough, thankless, tiring, and completely baffling. When volunteering, at times you might wonder why you're actually there, and you might have plenty of time to ponder these kinds of existential questions. For me, I had two counterparts that I was supposed to capacity build, and work with, and one of whom was lovely but quite competent and hence seemed to have little use for me, and the other one who did not want to speak to me. Used to leave her meetings without me and was rarely found in the office at all. So no matter how nice I was or how hard I tried, after 6 months, I couldn't even get a 5-minute conversation in with this guy. So it was making it tough to get a lot done. So I spent a lot of time moving around the office, trying to volunteer myself to other people so that I actually had stuff to do. So some volunteers are super busy, others less so. My next word of warning is that while the AVID program and others like it present a great opportunity to be financially supported to go overseas and volunteer, they're not without their problems. Last year, when I wrote my blog, it was astonishing to see the number of comments left by other volunteers who were also facing challenges on their assignments and who felt frustrated by the limited support that they'd received. The evaluation tells us that 30% of volunteers on AVID are not satisfied with the support received from their in-country manager. So even though the AVID program is standardised, the delivery of it by the different people and organisations involved can vary quite widely. One of the things that came up time and time again in those comments was the often massive disconnect between the assignment descriptions and the reality. So the evaluation told us that 44% of volunteers report that their assignment was not as per their position description, which is nearly half. So there's a number of reasons for this gap. There's often a significant time lag between the assignment descriptions being written, advertised, filled, volunteer being trained, and then finally sent. And another reason is that in order to get a volunteer, organisations need to jump through a lot of hoops to meet the program requirements and tick off all those development jargon boxes, right? So that can lead to assignment descriptions that may read like they've been plucked from some sort of sci-fi fantasy novel. Sometimes I look at them and think, you would need a decade in that volunteer assignment to achieve those outcomes. And that can be a problem across the whole aid industry as well, not just for volunteers, but it's worth keeping in mind. So if you do volunteer, don't only use the jargon and spin as a yardstick for measuring your contributions, because it may overshadow some of the more real, useful and genuine contributions that you as a young person can achievably make in what is often a challenging context. So with those cryptic assignment descriptions, it can be really hard to figure out what might be best suited to you. So if you want the best chance of not being on the wrong side of these numbers, I would recommend asking a lot of questions when you're applying for an assignment, interviewing, and before you go. If someone's been in the role before, talk to them, but realise that maybe it's been a while since they were there, or that maybe they have a bit of a nostalgic view. Try to speak to all the counterparts to an assignment, preferably in a one-on-one phone call where their manager who wrote the assignment description isn't on speakerphone talking over them. So you can actually figure out if they want to work with you. Speak to other volunteers who've been in the country and don't just ask about the snorkeling or the food. Ask about how they found the level of support from whoever manages the volunteer program in that part of the world for that provider. And most importantly of all, and I think my fellow presenters have touched on this, is to ask yourself a lot of questions. Think carefully about what you're looking for in the experience and what your motivations are for going. If you think you're going to save the world, you're in for a shock. If you think you're going to charge in there and fix everything or even anything, also prepare for shock. Reflect on whether you're happy to take a back seat and go slow and support your host organisation's needs and goals and not your own. Make sure that you're okay with undertaking an assignment that might not be anything like the description. Think about the type of role or location or organisation that might best suit you, your skills and your personality. And think about your expectations and then try to lower them. And if, like me, your assignment doesn't go that well, you're not alone. The evaluation tells us 15% of returned volunteers are not satisfied with their assignment and 25% don't stay for the full length. But it's not all bad. Well, my assignment didn't quite work out in a traditional sense. I got to spend time in an extraordinary and fascinating country as it celebrated 10 years of formal independence. I met some wonderful people. It was a brilliant reminder that I'm really interested in issues of aid effectiveness and thinking about how policies and programs work in practice. I visited some amazing communities in remote areas where you could really see some of the challenges that development faces. It solidified my commitment to work on many of these issues, such as gender inequality. And I realised that even though I had grand plans of running projects for NGOs or multilateral agencies in mind when I started thinking about a development career, what I really love to do is write and talk and analyse and dig into things and share ideas and stories, which is what I get to do now. And while I may not have contributed much as a volunteer, I do hope that my blog post opened up a conversation about the volunteer program, one that had never really been had publicly before, and that it hopefully will make a small part in helping to make some things better. So it can be easy to get discouraged by a volunteer assignment that might not have been what you hoped, or missing a dream job or grad program. But if my experiences show anything, it's that it's possible to skip or muddle nearly all of the conventional entry-level opportunities in development and still eventually find yourself working somewhere that fits. Sometimes the things you plan on aren't the best things at all. You can never ever plan on finding those people who will, for some reason, take a chance or two on you and throw you an opportunity. You can't predict the interesting things that will pop out of nowhere and take you down a path you never thought of before. And you can't plan the realisations and learning that come from even rather imperfect situations. So plans are great, and you know, maybe they're worth having. I've never really been much of a planner. I was glad to hear Jackie say the same thing. And it's important to take proactive steps to build your career. But my advice for those early in their career would be to keep your eyes open, be adaptable, be interested, try things out, take what you can from any mess-ups or missteps. Network, but not in that cheesy way, in a genuine way. Wear mosquito repellent in the tropics. Probably all work out okay. And what you really, really should do is check out some of the posts on our blog on careers in development and on volunteering. And you can find them under the Hot Topics menu up the top of our blog, including the one I mentioned before with all the comments. So I hope that my presentation was at least somewhat useful, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Ashley, and our other speakers. Now, before we launch into Q&A, you have no choice but to indulge me two quick points. The first is that the Development Policy Centre is actually promoting a volunteer position right now. It's in Papua New Guinea and with the organisation Family PNG. Family PNG runs the Lae Case Management Centre in Lae in Papua New Guinea, which works with a range of stakeholders to deliver services to survivors of family and sexual violence. The volunteer position is for a stakeholder engagement advisor and will be based with Oxfam, our implementing partner of the program, in Port Moresby. So if you want any further information about that volunteer opportunity, you can talk to our director, Stephen, who's camped out in the middle of the audience here, or Ashley down at the front. The second point is for any aspiring economists in the audience. We will be hosting an event in 2 weeks' time where a member of the Overseas Development Institute in the UK will be coming to talk about their fellowship scheme. Now, the fellowship scheme is an amazing opportunity where ODI will basically pay for you to go and work in a central organisation in a developing country somewhere in the world for 2 years. The general minimum entry point is a master's level degree in something around economics. But if you want to hear more about it, I strongly recommend you come along. It's on the 28th of October. You can find more information on our website or there's flyers outside. With those two points covered, I'll ask our panellists to come up and we'll open up to the floor. I'll take three questions at a time and then we'll open up to the panel.
I'd like to thank all of you for your insights that you shared with us today. So I'm Josh, I'm a student here at the ALU, and I have a specific question. I suppose you might like to open a few of us here. So I've talked to a few people in the development sector, and like you guys have mentioned, they've emphasized the need for a specific skill set, for example, engineering and accounting that you can bring to the development sector. But I'm doing pretty much a very general degree. I'm doing an arts degree, so I'm pretty awful at like engineering and accounting and all that. So what I'd like to know is, in this job market, I suppose, because it is still a job market, how do I increase my employability?
Okay, any other questions? Take Stephen and then the hat.
Yeah, I'll just follow up. I wanted to ask Alwyn. I mean, you're the one on the panel with a PhD. So, do you recommend that? The doctorate?
Yep.
Yeah, because I'm from Nepal and I had 4 years of professional banking career in international bank. And I had a very good career, got a promotion every year. But at some point, I thought that it's not the thing I want to work because I'm not having a direct impact on my economy or the society I'm working for. So I left the job and I wanted to work in a development area and I'm now doing in development economics. So what for the early meteorology for a person like me who has some kind of experience in banking or the corporate sector, is there any avenue in development sector?
Okay. Jackie, would you like to get started?
Okay. So maybe Josh first. How to make it more employable if you've got a general degree. There's a lot of jobs for generalists. I'm a generalist. I haven't really used my economics in any technical way since I graduated, and there are a lot of technical jobs and there are a lot of jobs for generalists. I think the understanding what job you're applying for matters a lot. So don't be applying for jobs that actually require very specific technical skills. But as Alwyn was saying, there are a lot of jobs for NGOs overseas that are actually just trying to get programs up and running, trying to get communications out, who are trying to get funding for programs. I mean, there's a lot of jobs out there that aren't technical jobs. So I think trying to position yourself to find the job that's not technical to apply for. And I mean, it is easier if you're in developing countries doing this. I really think your first jobs, you've got to be looking for them in countries. It's a lot harder trying to break into it in Australia. But if you're prepared to live and work in difficult places, then that's where you're going to get the opportunity to break in. I think Alwyn, you should answer the banking question as well as the PhD question.
Sure.
I know Alex doesn't want to work on economics. Right.
No, just very quickly, that banking one, I think, you know, I'll give you a job tomorrow, just pretty much. But no, seriously, if you know something about finance, then I don't want to say the world's yours. So there's lots and lots of avenues for you to get in. You know, you could take the microfinance route, you could get into impact investing. Understanding how money works, I'm gradually learning very late in my career, is one of the most important things to development. And it's and so many interesting and complicated and complex financial instruments are being developed. So I guess that's probably a little bit beyond where you are right now. But I think you've got a great platform for a great career in development. And I mean, I can't. There's a lot of avenues that you can pursue. Very quickly, Stephen. No, on PhD, no, very seriously. I mean, I kind of got a PhD almost by accident, and I didn't go out to get a PhD. I just happened to be working in an international research institution where everybody called me doctor anyway, so I thought better make it real. But my straight advice would be, I wouldn't pursue a PhD necessarily to get into development unless you want to work in international research, in which case you need a PhD and a track record in publication. You know, I didn't pursue that route. It's possibly bumped my salary up by a couple of points in certain jobs because you've got a PhD. Other than that, I wouldn't pursue a PhD, but sorry, Steve, I'm doing it at business.
Stephen, do you want to provide a counterpoint?
Someone else have a go.
Yeah.
No, it's okay. Passing the microphone. I mean, just on the banking one, I think, for at least for some NGOs, development is about how you shift the distribution of power and money. And it's interesting, your growth sector in Oxfam, particularly in terms of their advocacy and campaigning, is around finance. And they've actually been deliberately trying to recruit people from the big end of town to understand how it works from the inside and how to influence it. In terms of a PhD, what I found most interesting was sort of getting out there, doing some work, and then coming back and
taking the opportunity that study, structured study provides, just to reflect on the experience and to try and translate that into some sort of lessons which can inform future practice. So I've sort of gone in and out of academia over 20 years and found that really helpful.
I just
wanted
to add on a generalised question then, BA. I found my undergrad degree was in journalism, a BA degree, and you know, you always hear all the doomsday, I'm going to do and finish. But sometimes I think you have to remember that there's a lot of skills that you can bring to the table, particularly in communications. If you're interested in social media, if you're interested in blogging, these are skills that organisations are always looking for. So they may not be something that you have, you know, a subject in your degree, but just having some of those types of skills can also be a really good way to get in. And also I'd second Jackie on going to the country, because I was fortunate enough to work in Indonesia as a journalist for a couple of years. I also later on went back and picked up a consulting job in communications with the Centre for International Forestry Research. And that was because I had Indonesia experience and speak Indonesian, and also I had a communications background, so that's a good point as well.
Okay, another round.
There was a theme on, you know, being a specialist versus being a generalist. Now, when we look at, you know, the most market around development, there is that power struggle between the donor agencies and the recipient agencies. So, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but a lot of the donor agencies would be looking for a lot of specialist skills. How can you market a more generalist skill set?
Okay, we'll take two more. Yep, on two.
My question is to the panel as well, and relates to career progression in the sense of, is it more important to, so for example, in my situation, I've just finished my master's, I can go back and work for the same company that I was working for before, have more responsibility, or I can get a job with someone else and therefore have a more diverse portfolio and people I have experience with, different frameworks for project implementation, management structures, diversity of opportunity, et cetera, so therefore is it more important to be able to demonstrate greater responsibility but with the same company, or is it more important to have a diverse kind of experience in the network?
You guys spoke a bit about analytical frameworks. I wondered if you could just explain that a little bit better, maybe give an example of how you would expect potential employees to use them and what kinds of analytical frameworks you know that you use.
Okay, who'd like to get started?
How do you market a more generalised skill set? I guess my perspective is that people aren't just looking for specialists. And there are a lot of jobs that are around the technical specialty in development. I mean, I see them all the time. We certainly had a lot of them in Indonesia. When I was, I mean, I had 160 staff in Indonesia. Maybe 120 of them were Indonesian, but we then had 40 staff that were Australian. But of those staff, the majority weren't specialists. So I had probably only about, I would say, 10 to 20% of the staff were specialists. The rest were good administrators, good program delivery people, good communicators, good at managing funds. They weren't medical specialists. They weren't. I think there has been a shift over time to get more specialisation in, but there are a lot of jobs that don't require specialisation. I actually think, you know, maybe this is linked to the analytical frameworks. The longer I've been in development, the more I care about monitoring and evaluation. So if there is one skill you want to apply against any framework, I think it's having a really rigorous approach to how you can identify whether something is working or not working. And so I would always add some M&E and evaluation knowledge to any skill set you have in development, because understanding what works and what doesn't is really, really important. And I think of all the skills I look for, that's the one that I add to whether you're a generalist in a generalist job or in a specialist job. So I really think about that as one of the marketing strategies. I don't have one analytical framework, maybe I'm a little bit, but I read a lot, okay? So in fact, I was just having a conversation with someone a couple of days ago about an article that Lance Pritchett at Harvard Kennedy School had written about isomorphic mimicry. Now, so very, he always deliberately chooses these strange sort of catchy titles to get people, what is isomorphic mimicry? And it's basically that the theory behind it is donors are very prone to investing in institutions that have the form of a function, or the form of an institution, but they don't actually function. So they look like they're, you know, they've got all the people in the right areas, and they've all got job titles, and they're getting paid salaries, but they're not actually delivering the service that they're meant to do. So it's a and if we keep engaging with those institutions in that way, it's actually it reduces their effectiveness over time. I'm using it as an example that I think over the course of your careers, hopefully you will continue to search out and read really good analytical pieces about development, and it will make you think about your work very differently. So I don't have a single analytical framework, but I think you should be actively reading a lot and thinking and applying that, not just reading it sort of just as a document that's interesting, but thinking about how that applies to the programs that you're working on or the situations that you're encountering. So I can't give you the one, but there's a lot out there, and if you've got a curious mind, reading development books and then reading articles and reading blogs about development books, you know, it will spark you in a lot of ways. So, sorry.
I mean, just a couple of thoughts on the generalist specialist. You know, I agree with Jackie, and maybe one thing I'd add is maybe know how to make friends with specialists. And actually, what Jackie would also say was, what Jackie would also say, I'm sure, would be, as a generalist, if you're going to stay a generalist, then you have to become an intelligent customer to ask the right questions of specialists. So Jackie was surrounded in Indonesia by some really red-hot minds. But she knew the right questions to ask them, and she knew how to sort of work with them and how to use them. So, you know, I absolutely agree with what Jackie's saying. All these things, these are just from the hip reactions of, I don't know the right answer, you're diversifying versus specialising. I guess, I mean, off from the hip, I would just say, I guess a more diverse CV would appeal to me than a sort of someone who's tracked in one direction, just got deeper and deeper. I think, you know, particularly if you're starting out doing some different things, but that's really from the hip. I don't. It's kind of hard to respond. Just on analytical framework, I completely agree with what Jackie's saying. What I meant really was, it's just having a way of sort of, if you're in a foreign land, having a way of approaching. How do I understand what's going on in front of me, or what I see is going on in front of me? I mean, a quick story, perhaps. You know, I'm in the back end of Bangladesh. You know, farmers are just having all sorts of problems with their vegetable crops. You know, and there's all sorts of reasons for it. You know, the land tenure is an issue. They haven't got security of tenure. They're misusing fertilizer. They're misusing pesticide. I mean, 10 years ago, my development head would have said, okay, we need to run an extension campaign on how to use fertilizer better, how to use pesticide better. But actually, that wouldn't have worked. And so my analytical framework sort of was trying to get me to think about, well, actually, where do farmers get information from? And who? Of course, you can say, put this fertilizer on this week, but actually next week the weather changes, and should you put the same? You know, you need a dynamic, you need a system around those farmers that's going to actually help them make the right decisions. So actually, who does that? Well, actually, it's the people who they buy fertilizer from. You know, well, who supplies them? Oh, it's actually Bayer or Esker Genetics or some. Actually, those are the people who are sort of around the farmers. Do they ever see an extensionist? No. You know, so it's sort of, all I'm saying, I mean, what Jackie says is absolutely right. You know, read broadly. Just have a way of knowing how to sort of interpret the reality which you see, and how to ask the questions. And I mentioned the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework, which I think is a great framework. And it just, for me, it just sort of helped to order the world as, you know, I can apply it to lots of things in my life, actually, in my family, this room here, you know, the development challenge I face, or the market development framework, which is a little bit more complicated or whatever. But it's, and don't, maybe I've overrated a bit, but it's just, and maybe in an interview, you know, someone might ask you that, or read a piece, here's a situation, you know, what would you do? And it's always good, I think it's always good to have, well, actually, what would I do, and what questions would I ask, and And how would I not take this at face value? And I realise something's going on here, but I think it might be this, I think it might be that. And yeah, it's really just how to get your thoughts in order. That's all, nothing more, nothing less, I guess.
Chris, do you have any points?
I mean, just probably just to add really to what's been said in terms of generalist versus specialist. I mean, I think generalist almost invariably end up specialising. I started as a generalist, you know, a program officer, but invariably you're working as a program officer in particular countries or in particular sectors, and you do become increasingly fluent in those regions and sectors. And you do pick up quite robust program management skills, which is a specialist, specialist set of skills, program design, program monitoring, program evaluation, and I think working, as you've said, with specialists. I mean, you can't do this stuff on your own. You know, you're invariably working collaboratively in alliances to bring about change.
Mm-hmm. Ashley?
I would just add on the how to market yourself as a generalist. I guess from a communications perspective, having been a journalist, I guess you have to develop a sense of shameless self-promotion, which was part of getting my job here at ANU. I took Stephen's class, but then I also had an online portfolio that I could send to show my writing and examples of my work. And so I think that I mentioned before the skills in social media and things like that are important, but it's also really good to get your name out there and to, if you have work that you want to show off, to put it somewhere where you can send to people. Like LinkedIn is great, or you can use a WordPress type platform. And, you know, if you have ideas about development, try and get them out there. There's lots of different ways to get your name more well known. For example, you could write a comment on a blog. Lots of people might read it, and you know, you might run into them and they might recognise it. Or, you know, if you want to talk to the author of a blog and speak to them about work, then you know, there's a good way to engage with them. Or write to yourself. I think writing is a really important skill that is really worth investing in building, because I can honestly say that I've probably gotten nearly every job I can ever have, thanks to having been in the newsroom, had editors yell at me and tell me how bad my writing was for about 2 years, and listening to every single thing that they said and trying to improve my writing continually. So that would be my big tip.
So we just have a little bit more time for we'll just do a final round of questions and we'll wrap it up. So one, two, and we'll do a quick. You've already had one, so we'll do three.
There was a joke earlier about rusty tractors. How can individuals and organisations do more? How can they do more effective? How can they be more effective in how they do development? And that's something that's individuals and organisations. I know it's a broad question, you're probably going to fight about it, but you know, how can we be more effective in how we develop?
Yeah, great question.
Jack.
More broad question, I suppose. Also, if you could shed light on some of the books or podcasts or networks that you're involved in or engaged with, I guess get in your headspace and understand what you're thinking at the moment, your organisation is doing.
That's very similar to my question. I was just going to see if you've come across any particular books that you would recommend that are based on development.
No, I really like your question, and that is the riddle of life. And I boldly at 15 I said I can do better than these World Bank users, and I'm not sure I have. Just a few pointers. Actually, that article Lance Pritchard, right? I mean, he annoys me because he sort of claims this space when some other people have been sort of kind of doing this. But a hot word around the place is PDI. Hate the term problem-driven iterative adaptation. The guts of it is really about planning to fail. Okay, is when you do development, know that you're going to fail. Have a broad enough portfolio and diversity of things you're doing so that some can fail and you won't get your head cut off or your funding won't stop. And monitor the hell out of it. That way you'll increase your chances of succeeding, and then the things that do succeed support them to scale up. That's a really quick and dirty, but I mean, read the Lance Pritchard article, it's on the CGV website. Sort of what I like to promote is in the programs that we promote and manage is adaptive management. And it sounds like a funky phrase and it sounds easy to do, but it's not. It's making everybody on that team responsible for monitoring in real time what's going on the program. And 99% of development programs are not doing that. They are not experimenting and they're not monitoring and they're not planning to fail, basically. They're not planning to fail in small ways and learning in a real time at an adaptive way. But I mean that would be my sort of top of my list. But just on great blogs, I can apart from these and the podcast. So I wasn't concentrating, I was thinking about this question when you used it. But just Owen Barda. I think his stuff is fantastic. He's done about 40. If you go Development Drums, just look for Development Drums. He's got about 45 podcasts on that, and I think they're absolutely fantastic. They're very thoughtful. Typically, interviewing someone who's written an interesting book. Recently, he only does one about every month or 2 months or 3 months, but every one is a gem, I reckon. So Development Drums, I can advocate as well as these fantastic.
Can I just add something on what makes effective development? So I agree absolutely everything that Alan says. I think you've got to know what is and isn't working. Otherwise, how can you make sure it is going to have the impact that you want? And doing a baseline at the beginning and an evaluation at the end is not going. You know, it's too late by then to work out how you need to adjust it over time to be more effective. So I completely endorse that. But the other challenge, I think, is we need to be ambitious. It's not enough to do one good thing in one tiny little area. So this was the big challenge for us in Indonesia. It is a vast country, 250 million people. It would be very easy for Australia to do a wonderful small-scale program in one area, and it had a big impact on 200 people or 1,000 people or even 1 million people, and yet the other 99 million people are left out of it. So for us, the challenge was to have sort of adaptive management, but to be working on systems that are genuinely local and indigenous to the country. So that whether it's working on, we do a lot of work with NGOs, but it's not working with INGOs, it's working with the existing major NGO base that is in Indonesia, and how does that work better? Or it's working on government systems where there is perpetual funding. So if you can influence the government system through this adaptive approach, that it can be replicated. But if you're doing it with just a lot of donor funding, it'll be great, but it'll go nowhere in the long run. So I think that's the thing. Books. The last good book I read was called The Worldly Philosopher, which was a biography of Albert Hirschman, who was a really good development economist. It's a great book. So I thoroughly recommend that. Another book that I think is really interesting is Poor Economics, which is a sort of J. Powell book, but it's not technically, I'm not an evaluation expert, I haven't done any studies in evaluations. But you know, there's this great debate that goes on, does aid work? And I think it really sort of closes the gap on that. It sort of says, well, you can't prove in its entirety whether aid works or whether it doesn't work. We know that it works sometimes. The challenge is to understand, going back to Alan's point, is this particular program working or not? And it's full of lots of really good, insightful stories, so it's well written. So that's another good question.
I think that's a really fascinating question, and I think that's something that I really grappled with when I was deciding what to do with my volunteer assignment that wasn't really working out. I was certainly contemplating it one day, and I was crying into a coconut at the Billy Beach Hotel wondering what to do. But I think it's a challenge sometimes to know whether, you know, you're just not doing things right or whether something is fundamentally flawed, and that was something that I really struggled with and decided after 6 months that my assignment, there were so many roadblocks that I wasn't really being useful, and I felt quite uncomfortable about staying on in a government-supported volunteer role past that point. So I think it's probably a question that a lot of people ask themselves all the time in development, and it's probably a really good question to keep asking, considering. And just on books, I mean, I could recommend all sorts of books that you've probably already read in a development studies course, but two books that I read quite recently that provide quite interesting insight into poverty, particularly if you're someone that hasn't had a chance to go out into developing communities so much. was behind The Beautiful Rules for Evers. It's quite an interesting work of non-fiction, though it's written beautifully, it reads like fiction. And it really looks at some of the complexities of poverty in urban communities in particular. And for those who are interested in volunteering, another book that I've read, it's quite obscure, it's called Poems of Kalambaidi, and it's a returned Peace Corps volunteer memoir. There's so many of those, but this one's actually quite interesting, and it looks quite deeply at some of the challenges facing remote communities. So those would be my two picks, and obviously for blogs, I've one eye, so.
Chris, final word.
Again, fascinating question, and that's part of what my team attempts to do, is to build effective development organisations and right across this extraordinary diverse development sector in Australia. And certainly this notion of learning and adaptation is critically important. At the same time, is setting some minimum standards and holding organisations to account for those standards. You don't want to be iterating your way towards success when you're building a nuclear power station, for example. There are things you actually have to get right at the beginning. There are some minimum standards that need to be met. and then you want to build on that, obviously. We're looking at ways of doing this, primarily focused around capturing and sharing learning between organisations through establishing communities of practice and enabling them to work more effectively through sponsoring research, which draws on practice and then trying to translate that into communicable research products, which then can have some traction over other agencies. We invest quite a lot in capacity building, both in terms of building individual skills of people in the sector, as well as all around organisational development, trying to strengthen institutions. Still trying to work out how to bring all that together into a virtuous spiral in ways which do lead to improved outcomes. We've certainly got some evidence that leads perhaps to better performing organisations. Whether that leads to better development is the interesting challenge.
Okay, great. So just to reiterate Ashley's point, we didn't just make these two categories up for today. We do have two streams of research on careers and development and volunteers, so there's a wealth of resources on our blog and our website that you can go and make use of. But for now, everyone would just like to join me in thanking our terrific panelists.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.